Good morning, everyone. This is the Healthy Idea Podcast by Iman and Nico. I'm Iman.
And I'm Nico. And on our podcast, we sit down with founders on how they're using new technologies to solve critical health issues that face our society today. We learn more about their journeys into entrepreneurship and how they started their company.
We hope to shed light on innovations in health and encourage you to think what's possible with technology today.
Before we get started, Iman and I wanted to ask you to leave a review of our podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Reviews play a huge role in reaching new listeners for the podcast, and it would mean the world to me and Iman if you did. Now with that out of the way, let's get into this week's episode.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Healthy Idea Podcast with Iman and Nico. Today, we have a special guest. We have Hamza Khan, a award-winning speaker and managing director of the Student Life Network. It is a community organization that helps to tackle issues around student burnout and burnout in general and energy management. Hamza, it is great to have you on. Welcome to the podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here with y'all. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
And of course, my lovely host, Nico.
Thanks, Iman. Hamza, how are you doing today?
I am doing very well, sir. And yourself?
Fantastic. Thanks for asking.
Right on. It's a sunny, very cheerful day here in Toronto, Canada. We're looking out at a very desolate city, but I suppose that we're also looking at silver lining on the horizon in terms of mass vaccination.
Oh, yeah, hopefully. Definitely an optimist on that. And to just step into it a little bit, you already mentioned Toronto, Canada, which is already getting into the story of things, but I would love to learn a little bit more about you and your company, Student Life, as well as the other projects that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to keep it a bit concise, and I'm getting better and better at telling the full story of how and why I arrived at this particular junction in my life. I think in order for me to fully explain why Student Life Network and why Conic are such big parts of my life and why I express my time, energy, and attention through this, you know, joint organization, I have to explain who I was as a student and the circumstances that I experienced back as far as I'm going to go to perhaps the grade 11 and 12 transition into post-secondary. So I was an okay student. I was getting B's. I was getting high 70s, low 80s sometimes. And I had an inclination towards the arts. Now, this was particularly challenging for my very traditional immigrant parents, my Indian immigrant parents who worked very hard to provide a life for both of their kids, myself and my sister, providing a platform for us to pursue higher education. Now, shout out to my mom. My mom was like, hey, study whatever you want as long as you're great at it and as long as you're happy about it. My dad, on the other hand, was a bit more opinionated, suffice to say, and he wanted me to fall into the career trinity, the immigrant career trinity, at least within the South Asian community of doctor, lawyer, engineer. I neither had the aptitude, attitude, or marks necessary to thrive in either of those fields. But with that being said, I really felt like my future was in graphic design, videography, audio production, audio engineering. And when it came time to decide what I was going to do with the rest of my life, that tender young age of 17, I went to my pops and I said, hey, so I'm looking at this arts college and I'm thinking about becoming an illustrator. And he looked at me and he laughed. He's like, oh, maybe, son, you got to do that on the side. Like, you got to look at some of these Ivy League institutions, figure out the path to medical school, at the very least, become a lawyer. And you know, this created a lot of culture clash. It created a lot of tension between my father and I. And what happened, and I'm just going to skip a couple of the details. It gets really funny at some points. You know, there's this whole episode where I actually, in rebellion to my father, joined the Canadian Armed Forces and was an infantry reservist for a number of years as a way to assert my, initially as a way to assert my opposition to my father's blueprints for me. But all of that brought me to a very reluctant post-secondary experience where the premise of attending the University of Toronto Scarborough was not in line with my own desires. I just felt like I was going through the motions. I would show up to class late. I would leave early. I would sit all the way in the back of the classrooms, barely paying attention, one headphone in, editing some movies, working on some graphic design, hawking out some projects for clients on a freelance basis. There was disconnect between what the university promised it would do for me and what my intentions were coming into it. And this manifested as the years progressed in my educational experience in failing marks. I started going from B's to C's and eventually started getting a string of F's. I was at high risk of dropping out. I was very disillusioned as a student. I felt like I was burned out as a student as well, and that my career prospects were very limited. And what changed for me and how the story turned around, but you think about a younger Hamza that's on the risk of burning out in its third year and then nearly burns out or almost completely burns out, yes, around fourth year. What changed for me was getting the right message at the right time. I was walking down this hallway that I had walked by maybe hundreds of times in my undergraduate career. And there was this one poster, I'll never forget it, 11 by 17, beautifully designed, great use of white space and typography. And it posed the question, what's next? And it was a question that I felt I was avoiding for my student career, whether it was from that transition from high school to post-secondary and now facing the post-recession or actually graduating into the recession job market. This was a question that I had to come to terms with. And this poster made me stop for a fraction of a millisecond longer than I normally would have stopped. And it made me consider that there was this workshop which might be able to help me clarify my thoughts, a leadership development workshop. And so Iman and Nico, bringing this to a close here very quickly, I attended this workshop and I received the vocabulary that I had been looking for all along from a friend and a mentor at the front of the room by the name of Drew Dudley, another great person that I would recommend that you bring on for this podcast, who said that you don't go to college or university just to get a job or just to get a degree or a certificate, a diploma. You go there to grow personally, professionally, and academic. Go there to experience holistic development. It's a crucible of citizenship. And I was, you know, hearing these things and my jaw dropped and I said, wow, I've been going about this entire process incorrectly. And had I just engaged with the right premise, had I just tapped into the right resources, and had I understood at the outset of attending post-secondary why this was so important, my experience could have been radically different. I could have made up for lost time. And I tried my best to do that in my fourth year by becoming a star student, over-engaged, doing internships, coffee dates, informational interviews, starting organizations, joining organizations, the marks recovered, and I was able to graduate successfully. And thus began a long campaign to try to replicate that experience that I had in the hallway. And that experience in the hallway, finding the right message for the right student at the right time, is something that I've been chasing with every professional experience I've had till date. And I tried to do that by working at the universities and colleges themselves. I tried to do that as a student leader. I tried to do that as a founder of an agency through a soft skills training company. The way that I feel like I'm moving the needle right now at scale with that particular problem is through Student Life Network and Wyconic. These are Canada's largest student resource hubs that combined reach 2.7 million students, and they allow me and my team to reach students at the right time at particular inflection points in their student journey. So I hope that was not too long and too boring, Iman and Nico, but I wanted to give you the full spectrum, the full journey of how I went from a student that experienced a problem firsthand to being an entrepreneur and somebody working at the intersection of marketing and education, now even technology, to solve that problem in a permanent way.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely not a diversion. In fact, it brings up all these kind of trapped memories of, and I'm sure for many of our audience, of the struggles of college and even the struggles prior to college of what you want to do. And of course, the influence of particular families, especially if you're from things like immigrant families. I myself am, many are as well. And so there's a lot of variables influencing that. And then it's almost the extent of that it really impacts your mental health in college. Like, people get depressed if they don't feel like they're growing and they don't feel like they're being successful in what they believe they thought they were out to do. And having the passion and the bravery, more so actually, to pivot and try to find what you're good at. I feel like there is this concept of trying to find what you're good at, but also trying to find what you love. And it can lead to a lot of mental barriers.
Absolutely. And especially thinking about this at a time like the one that we're going through right now, at the time of this recording, it's in January. In the middle of the global pandemic, we're here. I'm not sure what the situation is out in Boston, but all classes are online. And I'm about to begin teaching another semester at Ryerson University, and all of my students are fragmented. It's a class of 120 students that are not going to sit beside each other in a physical classroom. They're not going to have those serendipitous moments of turning over and striking up a conversation before I start the lecture. And I think back to what my experience was, and you can imagine what your experiences were, Iman and Nico, of going through undergraduate studies and being immersed in the community, being around other people, having the ability to interact with classmates and people older than you and people that are new in their journey, professors, administrators, in this very nebulous way, in this very free-flowing way. And now it's become very isolated. It's become very rigid. It's become very cold and distant. And I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned about what this is going to do for students' mental health. It's the early indications is it's not good, putting it lightly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, especially for me, I think I went to Rice University. I was lucky enough to go to Rice University, and just my freshman year, a lot of growth, a lot of imposter syndrome for sure. But I loved it at the end of the day. I don't think I would change that experience for anything. Definitely would have did some things differently, but wouldn't change it for the world, because like I got to meet so many amazing, intelligent people, and I got to learn about different fields and different topics, and honestly learned infinitely more than I would have by myself.
That makes me really happy to hear, Nico. That makes me really happy to hear that you were able to make the most of your time at Rice. So those are 4 years or 5 years, depending on how long you took to complete your undergraduate degree. That was an opportunity for you to experiment and to fail and to do things in a relatively low risk environment where any employer looking at your resume won't have many questions about what you did for 4 years. You might have started organizations, you might have, you know, failed a couple of classes, but the only thing that appears, the only metric that appears, was that you completed your 4 years of undergraduate studies at the university. But it's the lessons that you experienced over there, the people that you met, the networks that you build, the scenarios that you rehearsed that I'm sure you've brought over into your current role.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry, just one final topic of this. I feel like
sure.
There's also this like notion of, did you explore everything did you explore everything that was out there? And sometimes when you're pushed into particular treks or into particular pathways, you don't get to see maybe concepts of engineering or computer science. And I feel like I'm speaking a bit for myself, but learning those things now, as my background was very business and entrepreneurship related. And so honestly, it takes bravery. Even post-college, you can have a trauma towards it of not feeling like you're, you know, ready enough to do something different. And it's really just about exploring and learning and not really having that fear of failure.
I love that a lot, Iman, if you don't mind me just closing the loop on this a little bit. So my mom jokes that when I was younger, I wanted to either be an astronaut or a farmer. She has little journals, little notes, drawings. She's very sentimental. She keeps a lot of my school assignments. And for many years, I thought that was what I would do. And then you could see that thought process evolve over time, where that changed into wanting to become a firefighter and become G.I. Joe at one point, a little action figure, and then become a professional wrestler. So much of who we think we're going to become and the career paths that we follow are informed by our socialization, the things we see on TV and on the silver screen, the things that are around us, our family, friends, and who we perceive to be doing the thing that we want to do. You know, people that we regard to be on the Mount Rushmore of success, whatever that looks like. I don't know what I would be doing in another dimension, because the series of reinforcement that I received throughout my life, I think back to maybe even in high school, I had one of my teachers tell me that I was a good writer, and that stuck with me. That stuck with me at a very foundational time in my evolution as a person. And then having that notion reinforced in post-secondary, and then getting the dopamine rush from seeing people engage with my content online, all of that sort of led me to believe that my destiny, the thing that I was meant to do, was work in communications. Now, once I was able to figure out my vocation, then I had to figure out an industry where I was able to make an impact. So all of that's to say, even now in recording this podcast with y'all, I feel terrible imposter syndrome. When I think about the focus of this podcast, I don't feel like I belong with the string of luminary guests that you've brought thus far. Now, I'm very honored that you have thought that what I have to share with your audience is worthwhile. And I think that there's something here. There's something here to what you said, Iman, and just drawing on that short anecdote that I shared about my mom's insistence on who I was trying to become when I was younger, now who I am. You can't always make the right decision, but you can make a decision and then make it right. And as we move through life, and I'm sure this has also been the case with this podcast and in your respective careers, you hope that the next thing that you do is better than the previous thing that you did, that it has more of what you liked in the last opportunity and less of what you didn't like. And in this way, your career, your life is a bit of an iterative process. And I'm sure that there's problems that we're going to solve through Student Life Network and through Iconic that we just haven't figured out yet, because we are still in this process of experimentation and learning about what our students want. Now, should we wait to make the perfect decision? Should we sit back and try to map this out to the nth degree and create a 100-year plan that we want to execute to a T? No, that would be a fool's errand. I think that what we have to do is just make decisions, commit to a direction, move in that direction, and then be nimble enough to adjust when we receive better information. Now, you can't always make the right decision, but you can make a decision. decision and then make it right.
Wow, I really love that anecdote. That one I will keep. Just to continue off of that, the Student Life Network and Y Connect, these seem like really passion, like oriented, and these things are like your babies. On the topic of like mental health and burnout and trying to give the experience that you had in college and trying to discover what you felt like you, one, were passionate about, but also felt like you were adding a lot of value to. How do you help these students, for example, who've made decisions and now you're trying to help them to make that decision? And a part of making it right is like balancing the mental health piece and balancing the energy that you're bringing to what you're doing.
Yeah, excellent question. And I can give you a quick retrospective in answering this of how we reacted to COVID-19, which I think one of the silver linings with the pandemic has been for organizations that were in the process of making a transformative change to their business model and to their focus and were trying to pivot. This forced us to expedite those timelines. So changes that were planned for 5+ years needed to be compressed within the next 2 in order to stay afloat and make a transition. So when I joined the organization just over 4 years ago, a very different organization in terms of the stories that we were telling and the content that we were creating for students. Our content division was producing blog articles, producing podcasts, producing videos and other stories that reflected their own biases as people that were outside of the student experience, and in some cases by decades. And so I felt like when I joined, we had lost touch with the end user. We had lost touch with the realities of our students. And so when I joined, we began that transition. And then very quickly, we experienced a bit of turbulence in the organization that forced us to become smaller. And what that did is it created a return to essentialism. Like, what are the things that we need to do to keep the business in the game? And how do we then create a business that will be able to outlast such adversity in the future? Such that by the time COVID-19 hit, the feeling wasn't that much different than what we were already experiencing on a day-to-day basis. We had become used to these kind of tectonic shifts in the marketplace. Now, with that being said, what COVID-19 did for us is it produced a lot of empathy for the team. I remember we sat down many times in the early days of the pandemic and said, what is the right thing to do in this situation? And the right thing to do, we decided, was to be present for students, even if it didn't make business sense. And in a long-term way, it always makes business sense if you look after your people, if you are there for them when they need you to be there for them. And we asked our students what they were going through, and they all said the same thing: fear, confusion, shock, disappointment. And we understood that for different students at different points in the student journey, those who are transitioning from high school to post-secondary, those that are transitioning from post-secondary into their respective careers, that they were now looking into a paradigm shift. They were staring out into the great unknown. So we decided to double down on providing helpful resources, helpful content that, regardless of where the student was, we were able to meet them with the right message at the right time. So this looked like creating a whole content suite dedicated to how to persist through and how to overcome adversity, how to adapt to and withstand stress, how to develop routines and productivity systems in the middle of a pandemic, how to transition to online learning, topics like that. We were then able to curate a lot of those content pieces and resources into a dedicated COVID-19 student resource section on our website. We increased the frequency of our emails and our touch points and communication overall with these students. And then we started to transition from that into creating really positive experiences and trying to replicate the missed experiences of the post-secondary journey online. So one of the things that I'm really proud of that our team worked on was we created a national online prom campaign when we realized that prom was canceled for high school students. So what we did is we partnered with a number of different organizations, including our lead partner, CIBC, major bank here in Canada. We were able to bring in celebrities, DJs, actors, so on and so forth, and create this one-night experience where, regardless of where you were in the country, you could dial in and participate in a coast-to-coast prom. So it's opportunities, events, content, trying to create as many touch points as possible for students to feel like they're not alone. And that was really important for me, because when I was going through my depressive episode in post-secondary, when I felt like I was at risk of dropping out, when I had burned out, it was crushingly lonely. And had I only known that there were other people going through what I was going through, had that experience been normalized, had I had access to resources and had other organizations done the heavy lifting for me in terms of providing solutions, I might have been a different person. I think I might have been able to avoid a lot of wear and tear that I experienced. And so I'm really proud of what the team has been able to do in terms of being present for students, creating a successive pathway for students at any inflection point in their student journey to make it to the next step, to make it to the next step, and eventually complete that transition from high school through post-secondary all the way to day 1 of their dream job. So that's where we're at right now. And it's spread spread out across several platforms between Student Life Network and Wyconic and all their subsidiary organizations and brands. What we're trying to do, we're in the process of bringing it all together with the help of a newly created development team. And we're trying to create a platform, a one-stop shop platform for students that are looking to essentially find the right school, pay for school, and thrive as students.
Wow. Okay. That was a lot. That's awesome. One,
thank you.
It's incredible to hear that you saw a problem exacerbated by COVID-19. And it's two-pronged, right? There is this problem of multi-pronged now, the more I think about it, but there's a problem of we have students who are already struggling in terms of keeping mental health consistent and keeping them in positive spirits as they're pursuing college. And then we've also talked about the complexities of managing that. And then
right. We
talk about the digital transition to education, and that in and of itself is pretty hard. Are students learning? Are they engaged? Mm-hmm. Is there value in terms of like academic content? Is it being absorbed? How are we testing for that?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is like this huge I'm not too sure, but this huge problem of what are the mental complexities of doing that? There is no interaction with people. There is consistent, like the reinforcement here is if I'm constantly on my computer and if I'm constantly putting in hours and I'm constantly putting in work, and I'm reaping rewards. And so
right. You're
teaching like multiple like mini things that eventually leads to this exasperated problem of mental health.
Oh, yeah.
And it's an unfortunate thing. And I'm glad that you guys are tackling it head on, doing things like multiple touch points. I'm assuming things like perhaps surveying students and trying to get feedback and trying to improve their experience. So they're still living life to the best that they can during COVID, but managing the mental health piece of it, because it's become quite a problem.
100%.
Not to bring it to like more of a business sense, but there's been multiple acquisitions in the space. And then from a college point of view, it's been very much explored with colleges utilizing these tools and trying to build a solution. There's multiple solutions. It can be curated for specific colleges. I really like this like open universe of here's a platform. You can access multiple things from this platform. And as a student, perhaps being more student-led, try to find like exactly what you need and test and experiment in this platform of how exactly you're going to derive some sort of healing from this experience. And hopefully maybe even post-COVID, I feel like this is a very like an eye-opening thing.
Totally, Iman. And it's so interesting. Let's bring this back to technology and disruption. So I've been in this space now for just over 10 years, and I've worked as an entrepreneur. I've been at the intersection of marketing technology for most of my career. So just over 15 years. And I remember at the beginning stages when I would attend these conferences and read these publications and hear from thought leaders about what changes were forthcoming. I'm talking about the early 2000s. They would say things like social media is coming and artificial intelligence is coming, machine learning. They would hint at it. They didn't have the vocabulary, but they would speak to this idea that all industries would be disrupted. And I got to watch as every industry that was prophesized during those early days, it was very like sort of halcyon days of digital disruption. Everything happened. At first it was media got disrupted, the music industry, then fashion, then eventually you saw it happen with food, and all the different industries were disrupted. The final holdout, folks, seemed to have been education. Education remained as this final bastion of change. They just refused to change. And it has been a long, drawn-out process to get to where we are right now. And COVID-19, unfortunately, was the death knell for organizations that weren't thinking about adapting to the changing needs and wants of their students. And so you're seeing it across the board. You're seeing students question the validity of attending a university online. Why should you attend the local university online when during a time like this, you can enroll anywhere in the world? When you're no longer confined and constrained by the geography, when you're no longer restricted by where you live to attend a university, if that's no longer a factor, and you can attend any university on the planet that is clamoring for students at a time when some students are just opting out entirely, it becomes really difficult. And I see this firsthand at Ryerson University. We are one of the most coveted places for students to attend in Canada, especially here in Ontario and Toronto. We have one of the highest, if not the highest, application to quote-unquote seat ratio of any college or any post-secondary institution. But with that being said, I can see this from an infrastructure point of view. As an educator, many of my peers are still struggling to transition their in-person classes online. And I'm part of some email threads that are just comical in terms of different professors who, in many cases, tenured professors, are just frustrated. This is not what they signed up for. They were under the assumption that they were always going to be in a physical classroom with students, able to do things as they've always always been done. But doing things because that's the way it's always been done is a terrible reason to continue doing anything. Newton's law really doesn't apply in an environment that is constantly being disrupted. Our time is characterized by great volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. And I think that students, I think that educators, professionals, entrepreneurs, anyone listening to this, if you begin to approach your work with the assumption that our world is only going to become more volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, I think you can start to make smarter decisions, because I think it's too late for many of these colleges and universities that haven't adapted. I think what's next is going to be some sort of a passport program where I can take courses online, I can attend training offered by Google and Amazon, I can pair that with internships at Salesforce, I could complete 1 year of my degree in California, another in Singapore. Something like that is months, if not just a few years away from coming into existence. And by the time it shows up, you're going to hear colleges and universities saying, no, this is not the way, but it will have been too late by that point.
Absolutely. The technological innovation in education and in training has just been, it's prehistoric. I had a couple of thoughts on this in terms of, there's a couple of companies that are doing this kind of-ish. They're still on the rise. There's Lambda School, which is trying to provide an entire college education to students, and it's completely online. Mm-hmm. There is obviously like the professional sector, so training in terms of like Udemy or Udacity or something in that kind of area, and trying to get people into vocations. And those have had surges during coronavirus. You mentioned something really interesting, which is that the educators are struggling to transition onto online. And so this could be like an after effect of just professionals. And perhaps it could be like a psychological effect of not knowing how to deal with volatility and not knowing how to deal with change. And that's a fact of being, of working, and just like living that I think just doesn't get addressed, and leads to a lot of stress. It leads to like negative after effects in terms of mental health too, not knowing how to deal with changes in work and in life. As somebody who's actually working, and I was interested in hearing, like, how do you feel mental health could be addressed in the professional sector? Because there certainly is aspect of the college sector. With COVID, there's been more of a discussion on burnout and on longevity because of work from home. I feel like there's just this like giant mask was revealed, but it's always been there. I'm curious, like, your thoughts on that, on how this can be addressed in professional sectors.
Yeah. So I do a lot of speaking and consulting around occupational burnout for large organizations of all sizes, really across the globe. And in my early conception and understanding of occupational burnout, I believed it to be an individual problem. And I think this was grounded in my experiences of having gone through burnout, not being a medical professional, and trying to understand what had happened to me from the literature that was accessible. And this was back in sort of 2014 to 2017, in the lead up to my first book, The Burnout Gamble. What has changed for me since then in speaking to and consulting with hundreds of organizations and staying abreast of developments in the literature and in the field, especially in 2019, the World Health Organization's reclassification of occupational burnout. I have come to believe that the paradox of why the awareness of burnout and wellness and mental health has increased, yet the rate of burnout has not decreased. I think that paradox exists because we've been looking at the wrong source of the problem. The source of the problem was never the individual. And I'm not ready to commit to that direction, because I still think that there's some personal accountability that needs to be taken. So I'm still very early in my thoughts around this. But what I can confidently say is that if burnout is still happening in organizations in the middle of the pandemic, I think that we have to look to leadership. We have to look to organizational leadership for answers. And I think that there's a couple of things that leaders do that preheat their employees for burnout. And I'm not sure if this is answering the question directly, Iman and Nico, but I think it's worth addressing for all the organizational leaders listening to this podcast, that there's things that they might be doing intentionally or unintentionally that are perpetuating cultures of burnout at their respective organizations. And I would say that some of those things are, leaders haven't defined what success looks like. The goalposts, they keep on moving. There's no real feeling of progress or accomplishments. And the one way to fix that is by creating some very clear objectives and key results. But that's an exercise that I tell you many organizations and leaders avoid doing, because it's hard to do. It's really hard to do, but it's worthwhile. Another thing that leaders do is they prioritize outputs over outcomes. And this leads to micromanagement and overall really poor decision-making. And I think that what needs to happen, and I'm seeing happen more and more with the pandemic and working from home is we have to reduce focus on optics. Right before this call, we were just talking about our respective setups. And, you know, Nico, you mentioned you wanted to get the green screen and appear professional, a little more professional than, you know, you already appear, sir. And I think we need to dispense with that thinking. You know, I came up at a time when my appearance was critiqued. You know, I wasn't wearing the right things. I wasn't dressed a certain way. I wasn't using the correct body language. But I feel like that was distracting. That was taking away from the real thing that needed to get done, which is the outcomes, which we've now learned that people are not only as productive working from home, working remotely, but in many cases, more productive and happier. That's very clear from the early research. A couple more things. I think that leaders, they assume laziness, disinterest, and lack of motivation. They encourage attrition. They practice what's known as Douglas McGregor's theory X style of management, but they need to adopt very much the opposite. Assume that people are well-intentioned. Assume that people are interested and they have intrinsic motivation. Another thing I would say that leaders are doing is they're not investing in professional development. And this bothers me a lot. Now, I was in a conversation a couple of weeks ago about how there's no room for growth, no room for evolution within the organization for professionals. And that bugged me out because I think it's a leader's responsibility to help the people that they are employing to grow as individuals. And yes, there's a transactional relationship to a certain extent between your employer and you as an employee, but that doesn't mean that it has to be permanent. That doesn't mean that it has to persist and you have to feel stuck in your role. Sometimes a leader's job is to help their people move on from the organization if there's no room for growth. And then I'll end by saying this, or two more things, if it's okay, if we have more time. I would say that another hallmark that I've been thinking about is leaders caring disproportionately about the mission. And why I say disproportionately, I think it needs to be balanced. I think you have to take care of your people and trust that your people will take care of customers or students or stakeholders or users. And in turn, those end users will take care of success. You have to balance caring about the mission with caring about people. And lastly, I'll end by saying this. I could go on I'm obsessing about this concept and thinking about this day in and day out, the role that leaders need to play. It comes down to this. Leaders need to create a safe environment, not just a physically safe environment, but a mentally and emotionally safe environment. And when we start asking questions like, how are you? I mean, how are you really? Don't just tell me you're good or you're great. Really get to know, how have you transitioned into the pandemic? What is your work at home experience like? Really trying to create empathy, foster a culture of empathy, and getting to know how your people are feeling, I think is so important. But I also understand why leaders don't do this, because it's difficult work.
No, most definitely. I totally agree. And that brings up a lot of questions I have, because this is a topic that I think about a lot, where I've worked at different types of companies with very different cultures, from very conservative, very formal, old fashioned, to more new wave. And one of the topics that you brought up that I want to talk about, so you said professional development is an important thing that actually helps reduce burnout. So my question would be, what do you define as professional development? And I think this is a really important question to answer.
Yeah, this is a tricky one too, right? Because there's professional development that is optimizing the employee for success at the organization, right? So let's say, Nico, you and I work together and you're working at Student Life Network or Myconic. Professional development on the one hand would look like you learning how to become a better performance marketer. That would mean you learning the different systems, how to be more effective in terms of copywriting, more effective in terms of social media community management, multimedia production, all of that. So that's professional development that works for the mission. But it is also my responsibility as a leader to ask you, Nico, where do you want to grow? How do you want to grow? Because there's how I want you to grow in the context of the company, but perhaps there's something that you want to do that is going to help you to be a happier human being, and as a result, a more effective employee. And so the question then becomes, do you want to learn how to become a better leader? Even though there might not be a clear path for you to become a leader in the organization right now, I think it is imperative that I help you to gain those skills, to learn how to become a better leader, to optimize Nico so that you stay in that frequency, you stay vibing high, essentially, ready to transition into whatever opportunity opens up next. So I think that professional development needs to be a dual-sided thing now more than ever, where we're helping people to achieve self-actualization.
And I think that's really important. And I want to stress, and maybe you've seen this or hear your thoughts on this, but for me, or at least for most people, I think when they think of professional development, especially when it comes to employers, years, it ends up being more so like workshops or trainings or conferences right. that you can attend.
Right.
But I think what that really needs intel when you talk about professional development is what you're saying is really asking the person, seeing the person for who they are and say, what do you want to grow in? Where do you want to be? And then they don't know, help your employees figure out what they want to do. You probably have an extra a decade of experience than your employee. So help them ask the right questions. How do I, sometimes that's,
and Nico, I talk about this extensively. So I've got a new book coming out on March 9th called Leadership Reinvented. And it was inspired by some of the early experiences that I had during COVID, observing what my individual reaction was to sudden and unexpected stress, and then seeing how organizations were reacting to it as well. So I've put together what I hope is a forward-looking, timeless book on the very human practices that leaders need to employ in order to have organizations that thrive in the future of work, not merely survive. And one of them, a whole chapter is dedicated to professional development, but looking beyond the things that you said right now. Traditionally, when we think professional development, it's like, let's send Nico and Iman to this conference. Let's sign them up for this workshop and make sure you send us your invoice so we can cover some of your tuition. That is too simple, in my opinion. We have to look beyond that. We need to ask the question of how do we create a culture at work where we do things like book clubs, where we talk about ideas and explore ideas in a safe space? Are there perhaps software that we could provide you with, apps that we can give you subscriptions to, Headspace, Calm, Audible, Blinkist? Where can you tap into sources of information that can provide you with the learnings that you're not getting from a mentor like me? And I have to realize that there's going to come a time very soon where there's going to be very little that I can offer you in terms of growth. So I need to eat a slice of humble pie and recommend that you tap into other networks, that you talk to other people in the organization, you go beyond the organization. Perhaps you even do something like a tour of duty where we say, hey, Nico, your job is protected for a year. We want you to go and work at a totally different company and then come back to us after having gone through that experience. We need to think outside of the box. We need to think about immersing you in different projects, giving you rotational leadership experience. To simply send employees to conferences, workshops, tell them to read a book is too limited, in my opinion. Think about professional development as a holistic experience.
No, absolutely. And the externship tour duty concept is one that I'm familiar with, that I've heard of people doing. So I know that Bain actually does that quite a bit with their associates. After the second or third year, they'll send them to different companies for 6 to 8 months. And then you give them opportunity to come back, see if they still want to be at Bain or if they want to do something else.
Oh, I love that so much. And I value that tremendously in people that I meet because I thought at first, because I've hopped around to so many different organizations throughout my career, and I always thought that it was a downside to my career path that because I had not shown quote unquote loyalty to many organizations, I've just been every 3 years, I change my job, that somehow I was less valuable. But in fact, it has only done the opposite for me, because I rarely go into any meeting, I rarely go into any scenario without some former experience at another organization, for better or for worse. And it allows me to confidently say at a table, when I was here, this is how we did it. It gives me a frame of reference. It gives me scenarios that I can pull from, which I find is to be a tremendous asset for any young people, especially listening to this. Embrace as many diverse experiences and opportunities as you can, because you're going to be able to stash them away and access them almost like going to a bank and just pulling out some money when you need it in future scenarios. It helps with productivity. It helps with leadership. It helps with overcoming adversity and building resilience. I can't stress the importance of doing whatever makes you happy until it doesn't make you happy anymore.
No, absolutely. And something that you touched upon that I think speaks volumes about leaders. So I've seen this from one leader who said this publicly before, back when I was in my past career, because I don't want to be too specific. But I was interning at J&J at the time. And one of the leaders on the organization was speaking to some of the interns, and he said, the best leaders help their people develop in the ways that they want to develop, regardless if that's at the company or not.
I love that so much.
And I think that always speaks volumes. It's one of the, I'll never forget him saying that. And I think that's, because at the end of the day, I look at it like this. You don't want, the last thing I want is an employee to stay at my company because they feel like they don't have an out, or they're already thinking about leaving, but they don't want to leave. No, I want someone to actively choose every day to come to work, that they want to be there, that they want to contribute.
Yes. I think back to this adage, Nico. It says, the CFO asks the CEO, what happens if we invest in developing our people and they leave us? The CEO turns around to the CFO and says, what happens if we don't and they stay? The downside to having a miserable, low-performing employee stay at the organization is disastrous, because it's just spelling doom over time. These people become closed off to innovation, new ideas. They become less interested and present in terms of actively sourcing ideas and staying abreast of industry trends and looking out for where the organization could go, identifying blind spots. Unengaged employees are a ticking time bomb. Mm-hmm. So I love what you said. We have to look beyond. I struggled with it. The first time one employee that I really invested a lot of time, energy, and attention to left my organization, I was heartbroken. I was devastated. I now am several dozen employees who have moved on from my employee. And I look at that as a sign of success. It's not a sign of failure. If I've helped them to move on, to grow, to learn, and then to thrive at other organizations, that's the best case scenario. Because in the process, what they did is they elevated my organization. They helped my team grow and achieve success. Are either of you basketball fans, NBA fans?
I am.
So you might get this analogy, Iman. We got Kawhi Leonard at the Toronto Raptors for a year. Mm-hmm. And that year we won a championship and then he left us and we were heartbroken. But you know what? He learned a lot and he took those learnings over to the Clippers. And we might think that we're a shittier team without him, but I would counter that by saying, no, we all became better through that process because we were able to unlock collectively new experiences, aka going all the way to the finals of the NBA. So mm-hmm. everyone on the Toronto Raptors benefited tremendously from investing in Kawhi Leonard's professional development. So I think about that often now when I'm looking at really high performing employees that I'm managing, that I'm leading. I know that for many of them, it's just a matter of time before they move on from the organization because they're not getting the type of growth that they want. So I'm constantly, as a leader, challenged to create more capacity, create more runway, create more opportunities for them, invest in their professional development while simultaneously accepting that even if they do leave, it's not a bad thing. It's actually the best case scenario for both parties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think this is bringing up so many things for me. One thing that you had mentioned on, you know, the Kawhi Leonard, and I would say that's honestly, Hamza, a good problem to have where you invested too much in an employee and they left, because I feel like you just don't see too much of it. And that's unfortunate because I feel like regardless, they might actually leave since you didn't pay attention. And you have to really think like long-term. If this was an
employee, they were going to leave anyways.
They were going to leave anyway, yeah. And think long-term. There's historic trends of industries where people are consistently leaving. And if that consistently happens, then there is no real growth in talent that's fostering new forms of leadership. And so you have these.
And look at it in terms of your own scenarios, Iman, if I'm not mistaken. And you've been there for a number of years, and I'm assuming things are going well. Now, let's say you both get to a place where it's time to move on, spread your wings, and explore other opportunities. If you have a positive working experience with the leadership, you're going to stay in touch with them. Mm-hmm. It's a positive relationship that both of you can call on for mutual benefit. Mm-hmm. So if done correctly, what you do is you produce alumni in the way that colleges and universities produce alumni. And that's how I feel with my respective companies. Mm-hmm. There's Splash Effect alumni, Ryerson alumni, Skills Camp alumni, Student Life Network, and Wyconic alumni. These are people that I've worked with who've worked for these organizations and have moved on, mm-hmm. but we remain in touch and we support each other tangentially, directly. They'll recommend people, we'll recommend people to each other. Sometimes we'll do exchange programs. It's a beautiful thing when done correctly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I feel like there's an unfortunate fact where some industries have yet to produce such combinatory effects where you can have alumni and there's just such a push out policy where I've seen actually in the tech sector a complete antithesis. And this is honestly post-college where I discovered this, and I have a really strong passion for like tech entrepreneurship. And people who work at like big tech firms, and yes, of course, every company has problems, but what I've seen is that a lot of people who do leave, they were invested in, they produce other types of startups, and there is almost like a symbiosis. There's a network effect where either the companies they've started are now like partners with their bigger companies, or they've been able to grow teams from these other companies, but there's still a good relationship.
Right.
That I've yet to see in many other sectors. And that is what I believe is like closer to what, I mean, I see it even financially as a after effect where the biggest growing sector is in technology. And I just see that pathway needing to be more at the head of these other industries. And I wish it was more like that. And hopefully it will be.
It's really interesting about that, Iman, right? Like even if we assume that things ended on a bad note, I think the industry and people benefit because the people who exit from that bad scenario will innovate and create a better solution. Like the best example mm-hmm. that comes to mind is Tinder. So Tinder had a very toxic culture. From its genesis to its peak, Tinder had a really toxic culture. You had the founders harassing their employees, just nightmare scenarios. And what happened is you had Whitney Wolf, one of the executives who was at the receiving end of this harassment, exit from the company and then found Bumble.
Yeah.
So this is a scenario where you failed as Sean Rad and whoever the the other founders were, to invest in Whitney Wolf to promote a safe, mentally, physically, and emotionally safe place where Whitney Wolf could thrive and potentially at some point incorporate the idea of a female-focused, more safe application, build it within Tinder. But they missed that opportunity. Whitney left, created Bumble, and the rest is history. And there's so many examples of this where the squandered opportunities are lost because, and I talk about this extensively in the book, and remind me, I will connect with you, both of you, after the podcast. I would love to send you advanced copies of it to check out, where I talk about this toxic leadership style that is a combination of narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. And I'm worried about the leaders and employers who practice, who are unbalanced towards those three traits, because that leads to corruption in the organizations. And it's only a matter of time before those organizations tank and take the livelihoods of people with them.
It's just financially irresponsible to me.
Financially irresponsible, morally irresponsible.
Yeah.
COVID-19, though, has been very clarifying. I think it has stripped away all of the artifice around these organizations. I think we can point to clearly who these organizations are, and we know, because we no longer have the window dressing to cover up the folly of these leaders.
Mm-hmm. Last point on this Tinder story, because I love this Tinder story, because I feel like this Tinder story happens a lot. It didn't have to be like that.
It didn't have to be like that, exactly.
Even if she had left and she had a positive experience and had built, and I would even say the solution that she built could have been affected by her experience at Tinder, but I feel like it's just a wider problem around how women engage in romantic relationships. Like, she was solving multi-pronged problems. It could have been a partnership. It could have been a much wider pie. And those long-term mentalities, I just feel like they're not being seen by every company. And like you pointed out another thing, this is a tech company. This is a tech startup. So it's not always, there are fallacies in every industry. It's just, something I've seen in tech entrepreneurship where there is more partnership than where I've seen in other industries.
Yeah, it was only a matter of time. And what happened, I think this happened in 2019, a business roundtable with a lot of tech CEOs. They got together. We're talking about Mark Benioff, Salesforce, Tim Cook, so on and so forth. And they discussed a way forward, because the excess and the sort of greed-based approach to building companies that got us to the instability and the imbalance in the world that we faced just before the pandemic and has been excoriated and revealed further by the pandemic. The way out of that is by hitting reset on the system altogether. I think the path forward is going to be creating value beyond shareholders, beyond investors. And they call it stakeholder capitalism, which is an organization now has responsibility, especially if you're a large organization, a large tech company, to create value for not just your end user, but for your team, for your vendors, for your stakeholders, for your immediate community, and heck, for the world at large. And organizations that are not down with that, you're going to see quickly become marginalized and acquired, dissolved, or go bankrupt.
Absolutely.
I think that's the way forward. Because we, when I say we, I'm a little bit older than y'all, I'm imagining. The two of you, the next time you find an organization, you're going to have more questions for that company than the company will have questions for you. That imbalance is gone, where once upon a time, you were just grateful to have a job. But moving forward, both Iman and Nico, and especially the young people listening to this podcast, they want to know what their organization's, future organization's approach to the problems of their time are. You want to know how your organization feels about Black Lives Matter. You want to know how your organization deals with climate change. You want to know how your organization spends its charitable donations, where it puts its money. You want to know the history of your CEO. Does your CEO have a Me Too case lurking somewhere in the closet? Like, these are things that are very important to you, because you understand better than my generation did and generations preceding me did, that we're all interconnected, whether we like it or not, that this is a very delicate crystalline structure that we're inhabiting. And we can't simply make the mistakes that brought us the 2008 financial crisis, that brought us Black Monday, that now brought us the irresponsible reaction to COVID-19, so on and so forth. So I'm really excited for y'all to check out that book. I think that I didn't know it back when I wrote it, but I really wrote it for the two of you.
Absolutely. I know we're really far in. Nico, I can hand it off to you. I know I've been like chugging along with questions. Hamza, thank you. I just want to note one last thing, is that the good culture wins, and that development wins, and that it comes back. Personally, I've seen it and I study this kind of thing. I'm like a nerd about it. Like, just wins. But yeah, Nico, off to you. Thank you, Hamza.
Yeah, you're welcome. Great.
Yeah, thank you, Iman. So I guess, because we are running a bit long, so I guess I have two or three more questions.
Sure. Yeah. I got time. I'm happy to hang back.
Perfect. Just the preface, I'm thinking, the next few questions I'm thinking of asking is, I would love to hear about, what are some characteristics, traits, or activities that current managers managers and employers might be doing that they don't realize is contributing to burnout or toxicity in the workplace. I think a lot of times when people hear these things about advice, they're like, oh, well, I already do this, or I don't do that. And so what are some of those like subtle things that they might not realize that they've been doing? And then the second question is, given the things that you talked about earlier about creating safe environment, investing in professional development, disproportionately caring about your people and the mission, what are some activities or what are things that employers could start doing right now to help improve?
Yeah, that's an excellent, excellent question. I'm really glad you asked that. I'm a big believer that budgets are reflections of priorities. And if you follow that logic, then the budget of your most important set of priorities, aka your time, your most invaluable resource, rather, is your calendar. And so for any new leader or leader interested in renewing their sense of leadership, I challenge you to look at your calendar and calculate how much time you spend speaking to your employees. How much time do you spend meeting with them? Do you even have one-on-ones? How often do they happen? Are they structured? What do you talk about in those one-on-ones? Like, take a deep dive into where you're spending your 168 hours a week. If there's no one-on-ones in there, that's mistake number one, especially at a time like this when your employees, even if they appear to be calm and composed and productive on the surface, trust me, they are like ducks sitting on the water. They appear calm and serene, but underneath the water, they're frantically pedaling their feet. People are burning out in droves. It's truly a pandemic. And this is not my idea. This is the World Health Organization saying that stress is the health epidemic of the 21st century. So make of that what you will. Now is the time for leaders to be more communicative and more present than they've ever been. So you need to be having more meetings with your people, have daily stand-ups, have weekly one-on-ones, and in those one-on-ones, structure them so that they are spent disproportionately listening to your employees. Don't just make it about a transactional meeting. Don't just sit there and talk about project updates. No, you can do that over email. You can do that over a task management, a project management system. Literally sit down and say, Iman, Nico, like, how are you? Since we last talked, you mentioned that you were stressed. Is that thing still stressing you out? Now, I'm not saying become a therapist, especially if you're not qualified to be a therapist, but
yes,
be a good listener. Ask good questions. Ask probing questions. Don't accept somebody saying, I'm good, or things are good, or things are great as an answer. Go deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
I love the Arabic meaning of how are you? I learned this back when I was studying Arabic, which is like, how is your heart? And when you think about that question, how is your heart?
Yep.
Holy shit, pardon my French. How would you respond to that? How is your heart? Like, if I were to ask you, Nico and Iman, like, how is your heart? I'm sure you take a couple of seconds to be like, damn, how is my heart? And you dive a little bit deeper than being a cognitive miser and giving me like, yeah, no, things are good. If I asked you, how's it going? So that's the first thing that I would say leaders should do. Be more communicative than ever before. And I could just go, we could easily do like a 5-hour podcast on advice, Nico. So I got to slap some constraints on myself and not overwhelm you and the listeners. I will say the second thing that a leader should do is stress that it's okay to not be okay.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think to expect a level of breakthrough productivity during this time is not only irresponsible, I think it's actually psychopathic. Like, to expect that your people are going to be on, that they're going to be working into the evenings and weekends and give you the sort of productivity that you expected of them pre-pandemic, big mistake. You have to remember that everybody is collectively experiencing a level of debilitating stress that, frankly, is existential. Everybody here has had their prefrontal cortex hijacked by their amygdala. Everybody is walking around feeling like they got to fight, fly, or freeze. That stress response is active in everyone. So you got to remind people that, hey, take your time. Give more generous deadlines, taking into account one of my favorite productivity laws, Hofstadter's Law, which states that people are terrible at estimating how much time it'll take to get something done, even factoring in Hofstadter's Law. So build bigger buffers into projects, have regular check-ins, remind people that they're doing a good job, give them positive encouragement. Now is not the time to assign something and walk away and just expect it to be done. Like, I have the onus is on me as a leader to check in on Nico, to check in on Iman and be like, hey, how's it going? Is there anything I can help you with? Remember, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. Just reinforce that there are resources available. Help your people. Remove obstacles from their path.
Mm-hmm.
And I will leave it at that as two like general things that need to be done. Number one, be more present, be more communicative. And number two, just remind people that it's okay to not be okay. That's a message that I think is being very disturbingly neglected during this time.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Hamza, to that one, I totally agree. And then if you are a leader, I would say keep asking those questions, like you said, and keep probing. Obviously, respect their privacy, but sometimes it takes a while for your employees to open up. If you started asking after working with them for like a year, now you're like asking, like, how are you? Like, how is your heart? Not actually asking, but asking for depth. Yeah. It takes a while for someone to realize it's like, what is happening here? It's, what do you want from me? So I would say keep asking and don't get disheartened.
Yes. And if I may add to that, I think this is a time for leaders to remember the adage of the things you most need to hear are often where you're least willing to look. Leaders are afraid. They're avoidant of the truth. They don't want to hear the truth because it'll cause them to contend with discomfort. But if you start asking the tough questions, it has dual benefits. So let's say, for example, you're in a one-on-one and your leader asks you, are you happy here? That's a question that you rarely get to articulate before you tender your resignation. By the time you've articulated that, you're ready to walk away. But if a leader asks that early on, that can do two things. Number one, that could provide the leader with information to help them contend with a blind spot in terms of something they might be doing or not doing that is causing their employees to be unhappy. But it also has the added bonus of helping your employee reconcile with that idea in a constructive way ahead of time. They feel like they're heard. Mm-hmm. They're able to express why they're unhappy. And then together you can work on resolving that versus the worst case scenario of them burning out on the job or persisting in a really negative state, becoming resentful and eventually causing, you know, harm to the company's value. So I feel like leaders need to ask more open-ended questions. Don't make your one-on-ones about transactional project updates and statuses. Ask the deeper questions. Do you respect leadership over here? What do you think this company needs to be doing better? How can I improve? How can I serve you better as a leader? Really, now is the time to embrace servant leadership as a leadership style for leaders. Become a servant to your people. Become somebody that approaches your work as removing obstacles from your people's path and coaching them to achieve greatness. I think if leaders can lock in on those two ideas, that's how we're going to get through this as organizations.
Mm-hmm. And then on that topic specifically, what would you say to employees? Or, okay, that's good and great. As much as I would love to talk to my employers about these things and answering those questions, what would you tell those employees that might be afraid of backlash? Like, I tell my employer that I'm not happy here, yada, and then I'm afraid that my employer is just going to assume, well, this person just doesn't have what it takes to be here, so yeah, I'm going to stop investing in them and get some, they get an indirect backlash out of it.
Yeah, look, I'm just going to keep it real. If you discover that your leader is avoidant, is aggressive, is authoritarian, that's probably a good sign that there's some dark triad of leadership at work over here. You think about some of the examples in recent memory captivated us. You think about Travis Kalanick of Uber. You think about Elizabeth Holmes of Theranos. You think about Adam Newman of WeWork. Hell, you think about even what's been happening in US politics. You see very clear examples of imbalanced leaders who have teetered away from positive attributes like transformational servant leadership styles, laissez-faire leadership styles, and have given in to what I alluded to earlier, psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and narcissism. And up into a certain threshold, you can operationalize those values and become effective. Let's continue on topic of examples. I would say Barack Obama, you might not think about him as such, but Barack Obama was a narcissist. But he was able to be a narcissist within the realm of functioning. Like, he was able to be just enough of a narcissist where it wasn't actually harmful overall to the organization of America. I would say to a certain extent, Steve Jobs was a bit of a psychopath, right? But not to the point where it was debilitating to the organization. He was able to operationalize some of the elements of that to give us some of the innovations that we benefit from today. But it's when those leadership traits corrupt, it's when you take those to the nth degree that you end up with the bad traits, that's when, you know, you need to look out. So coming back to your question, if you find that your leader is veering into the dark triad of leadership traits, that's probably a good sign that you should jump ship, especially if your leader is closed off to feedback, not willing to change, demonstrating a lack of empathy, not investing in your professional development. It's probably beyond anything that you can do to salvage that situation. Know that leader is eventually going to tank the organization. If there's anything that history has taught us, these organizations don't last. So save yourself the heartache. And I know it's tough to hear, especially if you're in that scenario right now, but you have to leave. You have to leave.
Gotcha. And that's, yeah, you know, definitely easier said than done. But I do think that's where that compass ends up pointing is.
Right. Now, I understand that you might be you're right, Nico, like easier said than done. There's listeners right now who are like, I can't leave. I depend on this job to pay my bills. I get it. I've been in that exact same scenario before. Bide your time. Do the thing that you need to do to get to do the thing that you want to do. Make sure that you're trying your best to optimize your time outside of work to look for next opportunities, to find ways to make things work. And I always come back to these three things. If at an organization you're not learning, you're not growing, and you're not happy, that's probably a good sign that you should exit. Now, if you're two of the three things, fantastic. Stick around. If you're one of those things, find a way to bring at least one more into the equation. But if you are not learning, if you are not growing, and you're not happy, then not only are you harming the organization, but you staying there is harming you in the long run. So this might be the push that some of the listeners listeners needed to move on from scenarios that have devolved for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, really powerful stuff there.
I had a quick comment about, you mentioned like daily stand-ups, and I've been part of teams in the past, either at work or internships, and I've never had the concept of a daily stand-up up until a recent experience. And it is tremendous, the effect that it has. I think, one, it just adds a layer of like reinforcement of you're part of a team. And I've not had that experience. And I don't know, just the consistency, I think, is pretty good in terms of getting everybody aligned on the same page. And I just feel like perhaps it's almost like a question of, where does the disconnect first happen? Is this something that's taught inherently in our systems of how we should think about leadership and being self-motivated, or maybe not self-centered, I don't want to say that, but just not incorporating other people as part of a team? Like, I'm questioning, what are the mechanisms that help build to what we would consider best practices? Because you listed out all these great best practices, and I'm actually feeling the after effect of what it does. And it adds to my productivity, because we align on the same information, we align on what we're going to do. I feel like I'm part of a team, right? All those things. Yeah.
So I guess you're asking, Iman, what is the downside, and why do some leaders avoid doing that? Would that be a fair question?
I guess, yes, that. And like, how could we actually embrace these best practices in a way that leaders from the start have like a playbook? Like, I feel like,
yes,
if I were a leader today, and my expectation of other internships and teams in the past, I did not have this expectation, because I also was not aware of how to align teams in this kind of fashion in college.
Yeah.
I was a leader in college. However, I could leverage things like friendship. I could leverage things like being in the same social circles, being of the same age.
Right.
In the workplace, there's a diversity of ages. There's a diversity of backgrounds. There's just so much, there's complexity in terms of being junior, not knowing enough. So your expectation differs. And then when you see leadership in a way that it's actually unproductive, and it leads to these things like burnout, mental health issues, if it goes down a toxic path, if you embrace some of these toxic principles, it's like scary as a junior person and a senior person. And so I'm wondering, like, how do you build that? Should you build that from places in college? Should you build that as part of what we were talking about, like professional development? Mm. It's almost like, how do you potentially solve the education piece? I love the best practices you listed. I just wonder, like, how do people embrace them or learn them as quickly or as best as possible?
Wow, you asked such a sprawling series of questions over here. I'll try my best to...
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just was thinking, like, I wish this could be done sooner.
And don't apologize. If anything, I feel like I'm going on these long tangents over here, and hopefully in post-production, we could make them a little more succinct. And guys, thank you for this opportunity to not only share my thoughts, but also to learn from both of you. I think there's so much wisdom in the questions you've asked. They're very validating to hear, because I think about them all the time, and I feel now a strong sense of community with you and the other listeners of this podcast. If there's like-minded people who are interested in these questions, I think the world is going to be a better place if we're contending with these difficult things. So let's start from why leaders avoid doing these very human-centric, values-driven, change-friendly practices, why they fail to engage in them. I think it comes down to basic human nature. People are avoidant of change because change produces stress, right? If we're looking at a very simple axiom over here, change equals stress. If you're going to change anything about your life, change anything about your organization, it's going to require getting out of the vibration, getting out of the frequency, deviating from the path, and adjusting accordingly. It's going to require time, energy, and attention. And it's hard. I get it, but it's worthwhile. That's the difference. Not all stress is created equal. We often lump all stress into the same category of distress, stress that takes us out of our equilibrium. But we have to look at the other definition of stress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S, stress that is healthful, that promotes positive feelings, that brings you closer to feelings of joy, and are in many ways precursors to the thing that you want to do, your goal, whatever, right? Everybody hates working out, but if you recategorize working out as a precursor to you feeling and appearing to be more healthy and more fit, and therefore able to experience the world more fully and freely, then suddenly your attitudes towards working out change. And this is actually underscored by Dr. Kelly McGonigal, who wrote a great book called The Upside of Stress. And her research found that simply reframing a stressful experience as one that produces eustress instead of de-stress is enough to physically change your reaction to the stressor. So start over there. Leaders need to contend with the difficult things that are in front of them. And they don't want to do that because they're already stressed. They're already bogged down by budgetary concerns and competitors and the stresses of running a team. So hearing more feedback adds more to their dashboard. But for these avoidant leaders, it's only a matter of time before their avoidance tanks the organization. And I would say the ocean floor of failed organizations is littered with the empty husks of corporations and businesses and nonprofits that fail to embrace change. And the best way for these organizations to embrace change is to maximize and operationalize the values of, or sorry, let me rephrase this. And Iman, you hinted at this. You have these diverse organizations in terms of people, their backgrounds, their views, their life experiences. When we fail to hear what these people think, when we fail to embrace their feedback, when we don't empower them with the ability to proactively solve problems, we disable them. And then we create feedback force fields where we assume as leaders, everything's okay. But meanwhile, we have people burning out on our watch and people becoming disengaged. And there's just countless research to support this idea that engaged employees equal, if your employees are engaged, your organization is more successful across all metrics. In many ways, I would say engagement is the super metric. If you're able to positively engage your employees, this has a direct impact on profitability, on retention, on customer satisfaction across the board. So leaders need to stop avoiding the truth. They need to do a better job of engaging their employees. And the last thing I'll say is think about these three factors, which compose what's known as the toxic triangle. So I talked about the dark triad of leadership. The dark triad of leadership is only one component of the toxic triangle model of organizations. And this is usually an organization that is destined to fail. So you have at the top of the organization, a psychopathic, narcissistic, Machiavellian leader. But then what they've also done is they've created an environment that is unstable, that has perceived threats, that has a lack of cultural values, that has a lack of checks and balances and an ineffective governance strategies. So that's the conducive environment. And then on the other side of that triangle, you've got susceptible followers. So these are conformers, people who have unmet needs, who have low self-esteem, who have low maturity. And then you have colluders. These are people who are wildly ambitious, who have similar worldviews to their destructive leaders and have bad values. So they reinforce the feedback force field of their leaders for their own nefarious ends. And then you have these conformers who are so disabled and overwhelmed by the experience of being in the organization that they never really give the information to the organizational leaders that they need to hear. So when these three things are active, you have destructive leaders, susceptible followers, and a conducive environment, that's how you end up with organizational failures, whether you're talking about a small business, a large organization, or heck, even an entire country. You know, leaders need to be mindful of these models that are rooted in peer-reviewed, extensive, science-backed literature.
Thank you for answering that. Sorry, Nico, I just had a really big question on this because this really has affected my entire working behavior, and it's something I've noticed. So, and it's for the better. It's added so much productivity, and I wish it was just better practiced. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. No need to apologize. So I guess for us, for our final question for the podcast, Hamza, where can people go if they want to learn more about you, your work, Student Life Network, things like that?
Absolutely.
Oh, I am so sorry. I had one more question. Sorry, Nico. I didn't know you were going to close it out. It was actually on your Skillshare, which I've seen has gotten lots of traction on LinkedIn. I wanted to know what kind of gave you the motivation there and what's the outcome you're looking for with that? Because there's one thing to teach mental health via counseling or burnout and stress management via counseling. There's another thing to do it via a Skillshare. And so I'm curious why the Skillshare route, why you chose to go that route?
Yeah, great question. Skillshare was a very innocent experiment. Skillshare reached out to me asking if I'd be interested in producing a course for them. And I looked at my roster of keynotes and I said, I'm ready to retire this one. Let me turn this into a Skillshare course, see what happens. The next thing, it becomes a massive source of passive income for me, but also allows me to reach a global audience for little to no effort. So this, in many ways, Skillshare, Teachable, Masterclass, YouTube, heck, even TikTok and Instagram guides, all of these different platforms are democratizing education in a way that I've never seen before, where it's so easy for you at any part of the world with a laptop, a cell phone, and a fast internet connection to access the thoughts of people like myself and people who are much more experienced, much more learned, to learn what they have to share. And so Skillshare for me has inspired new thought and a new attitude towards education, where I'm now looking beyond the institution. I'm very grateful to be employed by Ryerson University, to have the opportunity to teach formal university classes through them, to also run workshops through Wyconic and Student Life Network. But there's something about Skillshare that represents to me the future of learning is going to become very tailored to the individual. It'll become just-in-time learning, where whenever you want to learn a skill, whatever that skill may be, if you want to learn personal branding, boom, Hamza has this course called Do Things, Tell People on Skillshare that you can take at the comfort of your own schedule, in the comfort of your own home, or on the go. And this, to me, represents the future of education. It's going to become smaller. It's going to allow teachers, educators, thought leaders to connect directly with their students in a way that we've never seen before.
I apologize on that. So it was on personal branding. I am so sorry about that for saying.
No, all good. No, but you actually predicted the future over here. I am working on a course around burnout, occupational burnout, and resilience and wellness, which is also going to release on Skillshare at a date in the near future.
That is going to be phenomenal. I think I've not explored all the resources on occupational burnout and stress management, but I do know there are things like, you mentioned them, Headspace, Talkspace. There's acquisitions in these spaces. Wellness is becoming a huge space given the fact that work from home has pushed people to an edge. And
huge.
If there was an area of, what about self-training?
Mm-hmm.
Through things like a Skillshare, through things like your course, I think that's an interesting new area. That's like a Udemy or Udacity kind of stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Concept. Yeah.
Absolutely. All I got to say to all the listeners, strap in. The next decade for education is going to be wild. If it's anything like how the other industries that I alluded to at the beginning of the conversation were disrupted, prepare for a future that is going to baffle you. If I had to bet on what's going to happen, I think we're going to see the education model, the traditional education model, flip on its head entirely. I think it's going to become normal for students in high school to not consider college or university as an option, which is terrifying for me as an educator, but I think is really lighting the fire underneath the behinds of all these university administrators and leaders to think about how they can adapt to the post-virus world that we find ourselves in.
That's it for me. Nico, you feel free to close it off. I'm so sorry again, both of you guys.
No problem. No need to apologize.
No need to apologize. But no, it's definitely, we've been seeing bits and pieces of it in the education space for a while now. And I could talk about education in America for hours and my qualms with it.
Let's do it another time, or we can continue.
Another time.
I have nothing after this. Another time. I'd be happy to come back on, folks, or happy to have you guys on my podcast. We can do a bit of an exchange program.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I would love that.
And part of our podcast is to educate. So anyway, sorry.
I love that. I hope that this was a good podcast for everybody. I know that if you're a listener of a Healthy Idea podcast, you're used to a certain type of guest and a certain assortment of topics. But I hope that what we were able to do for you here today was open up some tangential conversations around leadership, around resilience, around education and self-actualization that might help the leaders and the youth and early talent listening to this podcast in ways that they didn't expect. I hope that's true for them.
Absolutely. Likewise. And so Hamza, where should people go if they want to learn more about your work?
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to share this. I would say the best place to connect with me is on social media. I'm very active on Twitter and on Instagram, where my handle is @HamzaK. I'm also active on LinkedIn. You can just search for me, Hamza Khan. I have a Facebook page that I maintain. Hamza Khan Author is the URL. You can find links to all of this at hamzakhan.ca. And if I may also just let people know that I have a new book coming out on March 9th called Leadership Reinvented. So if you really were into some of the ideas that we explored around the dark triad, around the toxic triangle, around being a more human-centric, change-friendly, values-driven leader, then I would highly encourage you to pick up a copy of this book. It's going to be available on Amazon or anywhere else that you purchase your books. Walmart, Barnes & Noble, Target, and it's going to be on sale March 9th. The title is Leadership Reinvented, and I will definitely hook up the two of y'all, Nico and Iman, with advanced copies. So let's connect afterwards. Let me get your mailing address, and nothing would make me happier than for the two of you to have copies of this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait to read it. Thank you so much, Hamza, for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you both.
If you made it this far in the episode, congratulations. You're one of our super fans. If you go to our podcast website, you can find our email. And if you reach out to us via email with one of your takeaways from today's episode, we'll give you a free 30-minute call where we'll answer any and all questions you have around digital health or startups.